This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Public education seems to be increasingly embattled, particularly in North Carolina, where teacher pay is among the lowest in the nation and where some controversial moves by the legislature during the last session negatively impacted already low teacher morale. Beyond teacher pay and retention is the question of testing, student grading, and the recent release of grades for individual schools. The hope for many was a broadening acceptance of charter schools as both competition for and an alternative to traditional public education. But in the last year, several of those schools have closed, some suddenly and without warning. Then at Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, there was the rapid and unanticipated departure of a golden boy in public education in national circles, former CMS Superintendent Heath Morrison. We're going to talk about all of that and more this hour. The school board chose Ann Clark to be Dr. Morrison's replacement. She brings to the job a deep understanding of CMS, having held a variety of teaching and administrative positions since coming to the district in 1983. She joins us again on the program. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. Ann Clark is in our Spirit Square studio, and joining us by phone is the chairman of the North Carolina State Board of Education and a member of Governor McCrory's Education Cabinet, Bill Coby. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
And back in the studio, Eric Gukian is here. He is Governor McCrory's senior advisor on education, previously executive director of Teach for America in North Carolina, which is why he was here with us the last time, I believe. Thank you for coming back.
Great to be with you, Mike.
And Craig Horn represents District 68 in the North Carolina General Assembly, a Republican in his third term in the North Carolina House. He is the co-chair of the House Appropriations Committee on Education and the co-chair of the House Education Policy Committee. Thank you for joining us, too. Welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Let me start with Ann Clark. You took over at a very difficult time here at CMS, less than ideal circumstances. You have also decided not to hold the job of superintendent for a very long time. You'll be stepping down, I think, mid-2016. How has the transition been for you in the last couple of months up to this point, and why don't you want the job for the next, 25, 30 years?
Well, the transition has been a great one, thanks to amazing executive team and great principals in all of our schools and school employees across the district that have really been the wind beneath my wings as I've stepped into this leadership role. I think, as it's probably pretty widely known, I had planned previously to announce my retirement December 1st to really take on a new step in my leadership journey in April. But clearly, at the time of the resignation of Heath Morrison, it was clear to me that a different leadership journey was planned for me, at least for a period of time, to allow the board to do a thoughtful search. And I think the community deserves a search for the next superintendent. But there was clearly on the horizon school grades, a tough budget cycle both locally and at the state level, and it just seemed the right thing to do for me, and an exciting opportunity to lead this amazing district. When I started as a teacher in 1983, I never imagined myself as the superintendent of the district, but feel privileged and honored to do so.
You took over, as we say, during a difficult situation, and despite all the things we heard about the culture of fear that existed prior to your taking over, how did you find conditions in the school system when you took the reins?
Well, that's what I've been doing for the last 3 months, is meeting with groups of teachers, community citizens, support staff, teachers, have a teacher voice session tomorrow afternoon, really trying to get an understanding of where we are as a district. We have launched a campaign in the fall called A Culture of Care, and we're certainly focused on full implementation of that, but trying to have a better understanding of our employees, what their concerns may be, and how they experience, expressing those concerns throughout the district, whether they're at the school level or the district office level. So and that will certainly inform any next steps we take as a part of our strategic plan.
When, if ever, do you think that parents and taxpayers will ever get a satisfactory explanation about Heath Morrison's departure?
That I can't speak to, Mike.
End of sentence. Ann Clark was recently quoted in the Charlotte Observer as saying that few things keep her up at night more than worrying whether the district will have the ability to fill classrooms with teachers. And that worry comes from, obviously, low teacher pay and low morale. Both the State Board of Education and Eric Gukian, the Senior Education Advisor to Governor McCrory, support moving teacher pay to at least $35,000 a year. Representative Horn, where does the legislature stand on that?
I think the legislature is very committed to continuing the upward movement of teacher pay from the floor upward. It's an embarrassment to everyone in the state, particularly the legislature, that we are among the lowest in the nation. That's why we moved to improve teacher pay with an average 7% weighted to the front end last year, and we expect to continue to move that floor upward this coming session.
And when you say weighted to the front end, you're talking about entry-level positions or people who with short tenures getting a significant raise, if I'm not mistaken. Correct me if I'm wrong, please. But there was some unhappiness with the way those raises were put together, because it felt to many teachers who have been teaching for a significant amount of time that they were being shafted.
Mike, if I can just jump in on that. Okay. You know, we had a $405 million shortfall last year, and I think this legislature put a focus on teacher pay and actually made a $350 million in a short session commitment to a teacher raise. And in the first 9 years, some of those raises were as high as 17%. And let me tell you why we did that. We did it because that's where the majority of teachers are. That's where the highest turnover is. And frankly, that was where the house was on fire. $30,800 to start is not acceptable. And, it had been frozen for over 6 years since the recession, and we made the call to do that. I recognize that we didn't go far enough, and I think there's ways in which we can reward teachers for their results-driven leadership.
That's Eric Gukian, who is on the governor's. He's the governor's education advisor, and the governor and the House seem to be on the same page. It's the Senate that isn't. Is that right?
It does seem that way from time to time.
What's the difference? What's the philosophical difference?
Well, first, there are two very different bodies. You've got more than twice as many members of the House as you do of the Senate. So we tend to get into the weeds to a much greater extent than does the Senate, who looks at things from a more of a 30,000-foot level. Secondly, we've got some folks in the Senate that are thinking very strategically, very long-term, whereas we in the House tend to think in a more short-term view, or take a more short-term view. So it's good that we don't always agree. We get to actually debate and discuss, and hopefully at the end of the term we get a decent decision.
Bill Kobe, you're the head of the State Board of Education. Is teacher pay a significant problem only in the urban areas of the state like Wake County and Charlotte-Mecklenburg, or is it a problem throughout education in the state of North Carolina?
I would say actually it's a bigger problem in our poor rural counties where they can't really supplement pay. But, I want to see the new standing come out. We keep saying that we're 46th in teacher pay, and yet we haven't had a recalculation since the raises that were given last year, and I think we've probably moved up significantly. Let me address teacher pay in a little bit different way. I want to compliment Charlotte-Mecklenburg for their work on the opportunities culture, where they're creating teacher leaders and giving more different types of work to teachers and team teaching. And that brings up the issue of differentiated pay. We need to pay teachers for taking on more responsibility. Our master teachers, our lead teachers. This is the future of education, that we can teach as a team and reward those top teachers for coaching and mentoring the younger teachers.
So three of you, Eric Gukian, Bill Kobe, and Craig Horn, all support this differentiated pay idea. I assume that, Ann Clark, you do as well.
Well, we've had great feedback from our teachers with the opportunity culture. We posted positions several years ago in the Project Lift learning community and had over 700 people apply for 18 positions from across the country, which was a loud, a clear signal that teachers are looking for opportunities for differentiated pay, for taking on different responsibilities, touching more kids, building the capacity of their teaching peers. So we have expanded that opportunity culture this year and will continue to expand it next year.
Eric, okay, explain differentiated pay.
Well, I think it's basically what we do in just about every other field, which is to pay people for their performance and for taking on and their leadership. And you know, I just to have it be a time experience matters. I mean, we should be clear-headed about that. But just to pay people just based on how much time they spend in the chair, I think is not a sound way to do it. I think we need to have more channels and choices to pay teachers more. You know, James Ford, from Garinger High School here in Charlotte, Mecklenburg,
Teacher of the Year,
and I went and visited Tyler Reams School, Albemarle Road. And one thing that Ann, I think, really summed up the Project Lift effort. But I also think there's a real desire for teachers to work in our highest need schools. And Albemarle Road Elementary is certainly one of those, these high poverty places. And I think that, you know, teachers ought to be rewarded for that as well.
The legislature is also very interested in this project. We've seen the success that CMS has had. We've talked to teachers across the country. The opportunities culture that we're referring to here, that's something we would like to make available across the state.
Where's the money come from for that?
Well, some of it, quite often we can do this within budget just by organizing or how the teachers are organized within a school with master teachers and teachers in classrooms, people taking on additional responsibility for additional money. So there needs to be as well some outside supplement, and we're looking forward to working with the Lieutenant Governor and his education endowment, as well as others that want to support this effort. Maybe do some pilots across the state so we ensure that we have picked up anything that's fallen off the table and address those issues, and then can move on to a broader implementation.
This is largely about empowering superintendents like Ann Clark and leaders like Tyler Ream, principals, to have more flexibility around money, people, and time so that they can move the money to where it's needed most. And who are we in Raleigh to make those decisions? These need to be local decisions.
And Bill Kobe, the State Board of Education is requesting state spending on education be further increased, if I'm not mistaken. Would that return funding for education to the pre-recession levels?
No, it wouldn't, but it would be progress in that direction. We need more money for implementing digital learning. We need more money for textbooks. We're losing what is known as race to the top money this year, so we'll be needing more money for professional development. There is a continuing long list, but our state board is all about innovation and support of the local districts so they can move the money around to where they need it most and that they can spend it more efficiently for their particular needs and their particular school district. I support what Eric just said, that we don't want to think that we can make the decisions for the local people up here in Raleigh.
Bill Kobe is the chairman of the State Board of Education. Eric Gukin is the education advisor to the governor. Craig Horn is District 68 representative and on the many, many education committees in the legislature. And Ann Clark is the superintendent of CMS. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and PNC Bank. PNC helps customers achieve their financial goals with the Premium Money Market account. Information about its features is available at pnc.com/savings. Don't have a strong gag reflex? Well, then you might want to skip our program tomorrow. Let me explain. For years, Wired columnist Patrick DeGiusto has written about what's inside a lot of the popular products that we surround ourselves in our lives. But now he has turned his attention to what is in our food. And the result is a new book called This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. It is surprising, sometimes off-putting, and usually pretty puzzling, actually. Why are these things in our food? We'll find out more tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the U.S. government is expected to make new recommendations on cholesterol, reversing decades-long advice to limit food like eggs. What's behind the proposed guidelines and how consumers can make healthy choices.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Ann Clark, superintendent of CMS Schools, Bill Kobe, the chairman of the State Board of Education, Eric Gookie, and senior education advisor to Governor McCrory, and Representative Craig Horn from District 68, the co-chair of the House Appropriations Committee on Education and the House Education Policy Committee. I was going to ask Ann Clark before the break if low morale is entirely tied to teacher pay, because we've heard about low morale, at least in CMS, and maybe this is pervasive throughout the state, I don't know. But Karen on our website has written, "My husband and I are both teachers in a small county near Charlotte. We have held on to teaching because we felt like we were too far with retirement to switch careers. At this point, that is not even enough to keep us in education. The system is close to imploding. Never have teachers worked so hard for so little money. Results, respect, progress, etc. The way we teach has been turned upside down by higher powers, and the teachers are paying for its dismal failure. No one is held accountable but the teacher. We are paid like Walmart employees and treated like dirt. Older teachers are trying to balance what they know works with the way we are told we now have to teach. Young teachers don't have the experience to know the new way is ineffective. They are teaching just like they are supposed to and are utterly defeated when the system fails despite their best effort. The testing is out of control. No one knows how to even prepare for it because no one knows what will be tested, even in a broad sense. It is not an accurate account of what the students have learned. Education has become data-driven, but children are not data. Data doesn't account for poverty, broken families, mental illness, neglect, abuse, hunger, and the many other things that our children increasingly face. Most teachers teach because they want to make a difference. The powers that be have used that to enslave us, to feel like we must give up our whole life, sacrificing all, even our own families, and take whatever they dish out. Teachers are waking up and walking away." I read that whole email because it came from a person who identified themselves as a teacher, and teachers are rarely heard from on this or any other program because they're teaching during it, and also because they're afraid to talk to speak out because they might lose their jobs. That speaks to teacher morale. Ann Clark, talk about it.
Well, and that's exactly why in Charlotte we're having what are called teacher voice sessions at 4:30 in the afternoon, an opportunity for teachers to come in from across the district. We're doing 5 or 6 of these this year, and really for teachers to share with us, you know, what are the concerns? What could we do to create better working conditions within the limited budget we have? But there's no question that compensation matters. And, you know, we made tremendous gains for our beginning teachers up to 10 years of experience, and we're grateful for that. But that was one step. There are many steps in terms of getting us back to a place where we're competitive as a district to recruit and fill vacancies beyond the borders of North Carolina. I want to acknowledge that progress, but we've got to continue to work together, the General Assembly, school districts, school boards, to continue to advance that ball. We are being expected to take on more and more responsibilities within a 7-hour day. Mm-hmm. And so that does create challenges for our teachers, our teacher assistants, our principals. We're fortunate in Charlotte to have a very dedicated team. But what I worry about and what I was talking about last week in the community is our pipeline, because if our children sitting in elementary and middle and high school are not seeing teachers who are proud of what they do. They certainly see teachers that are dedicated to what they do, but we've got to create the pipeline of the future teachers in North Carolina. And that is what worries me greatly, is that pipeline. How are we going to be able to attract some of the top students in our state into teaching and leading schools as principals if we don't quickly make some adjustments? And part of that is compensation. Part of it is building cultures within districts where we're proud of
but
what we do.
From this teacher, it sounds like a lot of it has to do with control of what they do in the classroom and being disrespected for not being trusted to do what they do best, and that is teach the way they know how to teach. And Bill Kobe, this person is not from a CMS school. They identified themselves as being in a small county near Charlotte. Obviously, this problem is a statewide problem. What do you hear from superintendents, from teachers, from principals?
Well, I feel for that teacher that wrote that note, and let me just say, I think the pressure is really on. And I think this pressure comes from being in a global economy where we are having to compete as a nation, being a state that has to compete in a national perspective. We have to continue to up our game. So then we have the introduction of statistics and testing. And so I think we're all feeling a tremendous amount of pressure. But let's go to the fact that so many young people are coming into kindergarten. They're way behind, many deficits because of problems in our culture of poverty and abuse and all sorts of things. And then the teachers are expected to do an almost impossible task of trying to meet those children's needs that are behind and come up. I think the bottom line is we're under pressure, but we're going to succeed.
Bill Kobe, I hope you can stick with us for a while because something just happened to your cell phone. Let me bring this to Eric Gukey, because not only are you the education advisor to the governor, but prior to that, you were in charge of Teach for America, where you bring in all these young people who are in other fields, who are planning at least to be in other fields, and they're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and they come in to teach for a couple of years in classrooms. What do you hear from them about what they experience? Because they come in very idealistic. How do they leave?
Yeah, I was one of those teachers. I actually taught in the South Bronx, and it's the hardest thing I've ever done, working in a high-poverty environment. I've worked with hundreds of teachers here in Charlotte and also in rural North Carolina, and the number one thing that, in my experience with Teach for America, and again, I counseled hundreds of them, the reason why they leave after a few years, it isn't money, and I don't want to negate the fact that money is incredibly important, but it's the fact that they don't see a pathway to leadership. They're told that they need to wait their turn for 10, 15 years to assume a leadership position.
Meaning becoming a principal?
Well, that's unfortunately the only way you can move on to leadership is through the principalship. We're not rewarding those steps of becoming a teacher leader in the way that opportunity culture is doing it, and that's why I think it's so important. The other thing I want to say, Mike, and again, my heart goes out for this teacher and for everyone, and it's a very hard profession, but I think we need to talk about students here too. There's 1.6 million students in our state. 65% of our kids by the fourth grade are not reading at grade level. And that's why I'm so excited about the work that Charlotte and other districts are doing to really put a focus on reading. And we need to really have a student-centered approach in the way that we're approaching this whole conversation. And if we're making decisions, they need to be based on students.
I think there's some other factors that play into here as well, Mike. Before I went to the legislature, I volunteered in a number of schools, particularly in Union County where I lived. I answered the phones in the guidance office to listen to parents talk to teachers like they were dirt. It was just terrible how some of these parents, and I can't blame the teachers for feeling put upon. With low pay, which teaching has always been a low-pay job, unfortunately, and unlike other countries. We need to raise the pay. But it's how teachers are treated by the parents, sometimes by the kids. Teachers are put upon to fill out reports. They are changing diapers in class for children even in the early grades. They are counselor, sometimes mother or father. The burden on the teacher is horrendous, and the kids are expected to meet arbitrary goals, and we all know that different kids learn different things at different rates. So in a given classroom, because our public schools take all comers, you're going to have quite a range of learners. And these and quite a range of discipline problems, of social problems, all those fall on the teacher. So as Eric just said, it's not just the money. Certainly the money takes is important, and I hold it important, but we've got to support these teachers across the board. Certainly when most of us were kids, we got in trouble at school. We got in more trouble when we came home. Now we get in trouble at school, and the parent calls up blaming the teacher because right. The kid got in trouble.
So where did that start? Because that is that I've heard this comment so many times from people on this program that the teachers are not given the benefit of the doubt. The teacher is the one that's blamed, and parents have at it with the teacher. Well, they don't. My little Johnny never does wrong. Where did that start? Where did the lack of ability to control a classroom by a teacher start?
Boy, that's a tough question. I don't know the answer to that, where it started. And it didn't just start. These things happen over a period of time. We have developed a little bit of a not-my-fault culture. We're always looking to blame someone else for our problems rather than taking personal responsibility. We also had the economy. When the economy turned down dramatically, there were no jobs. People that probably shouldn't be teaching turned to teaching because that was a job that was available. North Carolina in particular was growing very rapidly. But it's like a lot of things in life. There is no here's the problem. It's lots of problems. And we've got to take responsibility.
Within CMS, when a teacher has a problem with the parent, when a child is acting up, who has the upper hand?
Well, I do think that's going to be nuance to that particular parent and that teacher. I certainly, having been in this district for 32 years, on balance have had more often than not a parents willing to support the school. No one likes to acknowledge that their child is misbehaving. And I do agree that sometimes there's a lack of ownership. And at my level, I'm dealing with typically the parents that are the most frustrated and challenging of a fair process of discipline for their students. But my experience at the schoolhouse has been on balance, with isolated exceptions in every single school, clearly, that, you know, between the principal and the teacher, there can be a bringing together of the parent, not initially sometimes, but by the time that process has worked through the principal and the teacher, most cases, I think, can be resolved. There are, in every school, situations where parents really lack respect for the teacher, for the administration, for the district office. And so I don't want to paint a picture that, you know, we have it figured out here in Charlotte.
But does that sometimes come down to the fact that we don't respect teachers, we don't respect education, and that is pointed out by the fact that teachers are paid so poorly in many cases and are being asked to do more and more. And you're shaking your head no, Eric.
Well, we hit the largest recession in our country, in our country's history.
This is before the recession.
No, it actually wasn't, Mike. I mean, you're right. It was before the recession, and we have been underpaying our teachers. And I think when citizens need to make a decision about what to do, I think there is a large amount of support for education, certainly in our state. You have some really difficult decisions when it comes to raising taxes, Mike.
Those who believe that there's a contingent of people in the government who would like to end public education as we know it.
Well, that's not what I've experienced. I think you've got some very well-meaning people that are focused on students, and there are very, very different ways in which you can do this. And we should have a debate about this. But I think, unfortunately, we've gotten into this very partisan debate. And as someone who isn't a partisan myself, it's been eye-opening. I've got to tell you that we need to be focused on kids, and we need to be focused on the teachers and the principals and the parents that are working closely. I'm going to return to that statistic again. 65% of our kids, by the time they hit the fourth grade, aren't reading at grade level. We've got 67% of our jobs in 2020 that are going to require a post-secondary degree, and we are well below that right now. We have work to do, and I do believe that we need to We need to make investments in education, as we have, but where you make those investments, it's not easy stuff.
Well, here's one place that people want education to invest. We're going to kind of change topics here. The State Board of Education is advocating for more money to accommodate technological needs in schools. They say schools need handheld devices, digital content, better network infrastructure, technology facilitators in the school buildings. How does CMS do in that area?
We absolutely agree with that list that you just read off, Mike, and we have in our strategic plan a commitment to move to a one-to-one for our students with a personalized plan of progress for every student. We will, by the end of March, have placed over 30,000 Chromebooks in the hands of our middle school students, and we'll be looking to move that into the 9th and 10th grade, as well as bleeding it down to the 5th grade, with a ultimate commitment that we will have devices in the hands of every student. But not just to have a device and to say you have a device, but an opportunity for students to have that personalized plan, for them to be able to access content 24/7, and to increase the engagement that we're seeing in classrooms. I'll give you an example. I was in an elementary Title I school back in November. I walked into a kindergarten classroom. There were 18 students. 12 were non-English speaking. There wasn't a teacher assistant in the room. That teacher was trying to do a small group, and there were 12 students who were non-English speaking, five-year-olds. The difference that technology would have made in terms of what that teacher could have created for engagement of every student in that room while still providing that small group instruction would have been amazing.
That's what I wanted. That was my next question. What does digital learning bring to the classroom that that makes it stronger, better, more productive than traditional methods?
Well, first of all, you have access to digital content that's being updated every minute versus a textbook that gets adopted. In some cases, we have textbooks that we've had for 7 or 8 years, and clearly we know content has changed on a daily basis and certainly minute by minute. So I think the access to digital content, the access to assignments that can be personalized to that student with assessments and an opportunity for a teacher to monitor progress of each individual student and make the appropriate next assignments. And clearly the opportunity for a student to be a learner 24/7.
This is particularly a challenge across the state. CMS is, in comparison, light years ahead of some of our districts across the state. But with a digital learning environment, we will be able to bring the finest education in the world to the poorest and most rural student. Mm-hmm. So from the state standpoint, we are committed to a fundamental change in how education is delivered through the use of technology. But that means, from a state standpoint, we've got to step up on connectivity. North Carolina is the most connected state in the union, but we're still far short of what we need in the classroom with broadband wireless in the classroom. That's a state responsibility. Secondly, we've got to make sure that our teachers know how to use technology so that they can help the students, who often know much more about using the technology than do the teachers. And in fact, the people teaching the teachers to be teachers, they're the last on the list of who knows how to use technology. We've got the paradigm upside down, and we have to turn it over. So professional development is a key factor.
I have 30 seconds. You're the expert in the legislature on this, obviously. So what's the reaction from your colleagues there?
I believe my colleagues are committed to this. We still have a few colleagues that they find emails new and strange. But by and large, we're working hard to move toward that digital environment.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of our guests, Representative Craig Horn, District 68 Representative in the Legislature, Eric Gookie, and the Education Advisor to the Governor, Bill Kobe, Chairman of the State Board of Education, and Ann Clark, Superintendent at CMS. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Kelso Communications, the Charlotte-based full-service marketing and advertising firm utilizing traditional and new media channels to help companies develop their voice and strengthen market share. Details at KelsoCommunications.com. Well, the U.S. government is expected to make a new recommendation on cholesterol, reversing decades-long advice to limit foods like eggs. What's behind the proposed guidelines and how consumers can make a healthy choice? That's the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We are coming right back.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad of Radiolab. Have you ever wondered what happens to something when you're done with it? Talking about reincarnation. Sort of. I mean, imagine your car, the dashboard, the pleather seats, shearling, steering wheel, all magically transforming into an episode of Radiolab.
You're listening to Radiolab.
It is actually possible. Donate your old ride to us, and we will help you turn it into the programs that you love.
Call 1-866-789-8627 to find out more.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Always a lot of ground to cover when we talk about education on this program, and we're never going to cover it all, but I'd like to switch gears again with our guest and talk about charter schools. The former CMS Superintendent Heath Morrison claimed to be a fan of charter schools. Ann Clark, how do you feel about them?
You know, my belief is choice is important for our families, private, parochial, charter. It's my belief that it's up to the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools and public schools across the state to provide a high-quality education and to continue to push for that, and that we're evaluated every day at the dinner table in terms of how we do on that job. And so I'm a supporter of the charter schools. My only concern or reservation is that I would want the public schools across the state of North Carolina to be able to play by the same rule book as our charter schools. Flexibility is incredibly important, whether it's the calendar, licensure. Some of the things that our charter schools are allowed to do are clearly needed by our public schools, whether they're in rural North Carolina or an urban district.
Except there was an article in the paper this morning that says charter schools, at least in this area, aren't doing as well in terms of being graded as the public schools are doing. Every time they're underperforming the public schools. So why would you want to have the same flexibility?
Well, I think just calendar flexibility is a good example. Teacher licensure, given the challenges that we're going to face, opportunities to have discretionary dollars and not have categorical funding. All of those things are good for schools across the district. How they execute on that flexibility is a very different conversation.
Bill Coby, you're the chairman of the State Board of Education. The Board of Education also supports charter schools. Why?
Well, it's been well established that public charter schools are here to stay. This is what our legislature has mandated. It's all about approving quality public charter schools and then giving them the necessary support. Saying that, I'm with Ann Clark on giving the local school districts more flexibility, similar to what we give to the public charter schools. But I'm a supporter of parental school choice, and this is another choice for parents where the child is not a good fit for their local school.
Governor McCrory believes very strongly on this one that in order for us to have a thriving charter movement, that charters need to be held to account and they need to be excellent, and they also need to be transparent about how they're spending tax dollars. And we took a pretty strong stand on this last legislative session, and we're going to continue to hold the bar very high. I think we should only be accepting charters in our state that are have the kind of performance metrics and are reaching that excellence.
The legislature made the rules for charter schools. Maybe not the one you're in, but our previous legislature did. Why are the rules different? All the money comes from the same tax dollar pile, and matter of fact, the public schools have to pay the charter schools. The money comes from the public school budget to support these charter schools. Why are they operating under different sets of rules?
Well, we go back to something that we said earlier, that different kids learn different things in different ways and at different rates. So the need for some alternatives for some kids was apparent. The charter schools, I do agree that we need to review how we allow charters and how we hold them accountable. But the concept of a charter school, given a charter to perform a particular activity, is a sound concept.
How many charter schools do we have in North Carolina?
Well, it was capped at 100 for a very long time. That cap was lifted in 2010 2011. I think we have somewhere around 125, 130.
How many of them are successful?
What you found with and this is one metric, as I think Anne in her editorial very rightly said, but with the A through F, there were 12% of the charters that were A's and 12% that were F's. Mm-hmm. In the public schools, it was roughly 6 and 6 on that framework. Obviously, there's a lot more public schools, and I think that's important to note that even if charters go gangbusters, you're probably talking less than 10%.
But we've had several in Charlotte that have failed without making it through a single year. They just closed their doors, and a state audit came back recently for a school that closed in Kinston that showed some questionable practices involving the use of funding. How do you ensure both the quality and the fiscal responsibility of these schools and the people who operate them?
Well, I think you do that at first by holding the bar very high in terms of what charters you accept. And the Charter Advisory Board this last time around, there were over 70 applicants, and just over 15 were accepted. So I think that bar is getting higher.
Many, if not most, of these charter schools which get public funding are for-profit organizations. Representative Horn, how carefully are these operators of these schools vetted prior to opening, and how closely are their operations audited, and why should a school that's getting public tax dollars be a for-profit organization?
Well, I don't have a particular heartburn with for-profit. Profit can drive quality.
Why are tax dollars going to a for-profit institution?
Well, that's how the charter school is organized, and you can see that charters are need to be held, obviously, to a higher level of accountability on the finance and governance side. I believe that as we lifted that cap and allowed some new operators to come in, we paid a lot of attention to the academic side, but without the fundamental strength in governance and in finances, you're going to have people that are – go ahead.
Many people want vouchers so they can send their kids to private school. What's the difference in giving a parent a voucher to send their child to a private for-profit school versus giving them an opportunity to go to a charter school that is taking tax money to run a for-profit business?
Let me just interrupt. I think it's actually a misnomer to say that most charter schools are private. That's not true. I think the majority of them are nonprofits. And the majority and all of the charters are public schools, so they're not private schools. That's an important distinction, I think, that we ought to make on this, and I just wanted to share that.
So they have to accept anybody?
No, that's not what I said. What I said was that it's not a private school, and there's a difference.
Well, there's a difference between a public school who has to take everybody, anybody who walks in the door, and a charter school that doesn't, that's getting tax money. And I think that's something that needs to be clarified.
Right, and I think we have examples of charters like KIPP here in Charlotte, the Charlotte Lab School, which is about to open up. And these are excellent and outstanding charter schools. And I think the way charters began supported by Bill Clinton and President Obama and others. The reason why these began is because they can be examples of excellence, and we should be sharing our learnings with traditional public schools. And there's been some real examples.
If
I could finish, there's been examples in places like New Orleans where charters have led to dramatic gains in student achievement.
So if a charter does something particularly well and they're having great success at it, do the public schools have the freedom to duplicate that effort in every way, or are they under different rules?
Well, the public schools do play by a different rule book. There's not the autonomy and flexibility that our charters enjoy.
So if you saw something that was taking off like gangbusters at a charter school, obviously working and working well for students, you couldn't do it necessarily.
Well, if it had anything to do with the flexibility in the calendar or perhaps flexibility in staffing, under the current rule book, we would not be able to do that. However, we have been able to partner with several charters here, Sugar Creek Charter, KIPP, our recent MOU between Renaissance West that was on a trajectory to be a charter school, where the district has been able to come together with an organization to collaborate on the opening of a school at Renaissance West. And so we're excited about those opportunities when we can collaborate and come up with an MOU that exercises the flexibility we do have in public education, but also brings the best practices that a potential charter has.
Bill Kobe, we also
– Hey, Mike.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Can I weigh in here? All of the public charter schools are run by nonprofit boards. In some cases, they choose to have an education management organization, which is a for-profit group. But as Eric has said, we have forced total disclosure of how the public monies are being spent. Also, public charter schools, the admission to them is based on a lottery. So if you don't get through the lottery, you don't get into the schools. So the public charter schools are open to all students, but they don't necessarily get in because they don't win a lottery.
So, Bill Coby, we also have two virtual charter schools opening in the fall, I believe. How will they work?
Very similar to the brick-and-mortar charters. The legislature mandated that we have two pilot virtual charter schools. The enrollment will be limited to 1,500 students, K through 12, and from what we hear, there'll be a very high demand for those slots, and it'll be determined by lottery as to who gets in. Again, both of them are run by nonprofit boards, but both of them have contracted with education management organizations that are for-profit entities.
And Representative Horn, you feel that online charters or virtual charters are part of the landscape of the future of education. Do you, to use your words, why?
I believe that that's true. We have a lot of kids in our state that have varying needs, whether it be because they're athletes and are in a training regimen or in another field of the arts that cause them to be unavailable for a traditional schedule. We have kids that have various learning challenges or opportunities that are more fully met by having access to a virtual environment instead of a traditional bricks and mortar. I think it's all part of the larger landscape of how we're going to change the delivery system of education.
Will public schools eventually have that available to them, do you think?
I believe that public schools will. Public schools already are utilizing virtual, not virtual charters, but virtual public education, because North Carolina has a virtual public school.
One local school board member, John Tate, fears that these online charter schools will become schools of the privileged because they require a computer and internet access. Does he have a point?
Actually, CMS will be opening up a virtual high school next fall, and we've created an opportunity where students can learn at home or come in to the Performance Learning Center, where we have a blended learning environment already and teachers that will be available to support those students as they need additional instruction or, you know, support either using the technology or with the content. So we're moving forward, and I've had good response from our students to that option.
Will there be a virtual or fantasy football team?
Can I make a comment here?
Yeah.
I want to correct a misperception there. One of the things that we have required of these new virtual charter schools, that if any child is on a free or reduced lunch plan, the virtual charter school has to supply them with both access and a computer device or a digital device. So we've covered that. I also want to compliment Charlotte Mecklenburg. I know that they're offering a lot more parental choice within their school district, and I think that's not the only reason why we had several charter failures down there, but I think that's a part of the reason why those charters failed, is that the school district, CMS, is really being very aggressive and offering a choice, as Ann just said, by opening the virtual charter high school and a number of other things.
And Mike, I do appreciate what you said about the digital divide in our state and in our country. And Governor McCrory and this General Assembly is, and frankly, governors before and General Assemblies before in North Carolina have been very committed to bridging that digital divide. We are in the last mile of making sure that every kid has one-to-one access, and that moves us into the 21st century.
And also, Mike, in Union County, Superintendent Mary Ellis has said that it's not a one-size-fits-all, it's what size fits me, and that the public schools often are the best choice for the needs of the child, and especially when you have someone like Ann Clark here leading CMS as well as Mary Ellis in Union County with lots of varying opportunities that in fact they present the best choice for most children, but not for all children.
State Board of Education recently implemented this new 10-point grading scale for public high schools, or at least it will be in the fall, I believe. Bill Coby, why is the state moving in this direction? What do you hope to achieve by this?
Well, most of the country is on a 10-point scale, and this has really been a grassroots effort by superintendents, parents, and students urging us to go in this direction. So I think there is widespread support for it being implemented this next fall.
And so if a school gets a low grade or if a school gets a high grade, what are parents to do with that information?
Well, that's different from the 10-point grading scale. You're speaking, I think, now to the A through F.
Yes, the A through F. Go ahead.
Well, I think the number one thing that reveals is something we've always known, but now we have it in stark terms, that basically low-performing schools are the schools that have more children in poverty.
I have 3 points on the A through F. One is I think we need to celebrate the schools that exceeded their growth goals. Two is I think we should be asking two questions. What can we learn from the schools that are getting A's, especially those that are getting A's with majority poverty populations? And finally, how can we support those schools that are struggling? And that's probably the most important one.
That's Eric Gookie, who's Senior Education Advisor in the Office of the Governor, Governor McCrory. Representative Craig Horn joined us from District 68. He's the co-chair of the House Appropriations Committee on Education and the House Education Policy Committee. Bill Coby is the chairman of the State Board of Education, and Ann Clark is superintendent of CMS. We haven't even scratched the surface. We could go another couple of hours, but unfortunately our time is over, and I thank you all for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks.